See a lot of you. It's like being in the Hall of Fame of the Navigators with all of you who, many of you who have impacted my own life, and it's fun to see you all here. Tomorrow I speak with the Edge Corps, the opposite end of all of it. Have you ever been around those? Drop in. If you think you don't have a lot of hope going for the future of this world, you just get around the Edge Corps. They haven't heard that. It's really kind of exciting.
We prayed for them
when they were all here?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. That's real good. Well, I'd like to just go through a lot of information. And there'll be things that I'll have here that you'll not be able to keep up. If you still have that old navigator tendency to copy everything down that goes up, please set it aside. Anything that's worthwhile to you, please let me know, and I will be glad to just reproduce it, send it to you, give some background on it. But I'd like to just give you some exposure, because I think for us, of us here, particularly in the 50-plus as we go on in life, and particularly through the navigators, we have before us probably some of the greatest opportunities for impact we'll ever have. And some of you are already making that kind of impact. I was impressed when I was looking through the one psalm that Moses wrote, Psalm 90. And he writes in verse 12 and 17, we know it well. But it's an interesting book. We see what we can learn from the life of, from the prayer of Moses. And I won't be speaking on this. I just want to bring a thought out of it. Because you get perspective and meaning. From a person looking back and praying and asking God some things. In verse 12, he says, "Trust, teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." In other words, he's saying, teach us to wisely apply ourselves so that our lives will count. And then over, he goes through a few more verses in his prayer and ends off with 17. "May the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands." Yes, establish the work of our hands. And I think what he's saying there is, Lord, make the efforts of a lifetime really count. And that's really what we want. Some of us feel like, if I could just get another shot at it, I do things differently. I often go back and I look at some of the mistakes that I see happening in the military, for instance. I say, well, maybe if I would have stayed on or go back and give it another try, or some of these other things that you've done one time in life. But now's the time to go back and you say, well, you know, it's all out there. It's all done. But there are some years ahead. And so, Lord, make the efforts of a lifetime really count. These last years really count. The ones that have invested really count. And so, with that in mind, of course, you just are greatly challenged to think, now, where are we going? What are we doing? And so I'd like to really share with you a number of things about one great way to invest your life, but also some things about transitioning in our own lives. I was curious, if you'll see in the very first page, right after the title page, there's a quote. And it's from Bobby Clinton, who's a good friend of mine, and I'm sure some of yours as well. And I got it from one of his new studies that he's done on the focused life. You'll see I've just quoted there in italics. Leaders must make decisions about life and ministry which flow from their understanding of who God has made them to be and for what God has shaped them. These decisions will lead them to effective, purposeful lives which in retrospect will be seen to have been focused lives. And as you get older, whether it's 20 to 30 or 30 to 40, we should be tending to be more focused in our lives. And I was intrigued by this because it's really true. The part of decisions that we'll make will come out of what has God made us to be. And so that wherever you are, whether you're a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 50-year-old or 60 or whatever it is, what has God made me to be today? Not what I used to be, but what has God made me today? And that should shape a lot of what I give myself to do. It also says, for what God has not only shaped me and made me, but these decisions will effectively move me to a purposeful, meaningful life. More focus to it. And as we get older, the focus should come down more clear, be more consistent with who we are, more consistent with our gifting. We know so much about our lives. The data is just rich. It's full. And so these future years ought to be very focused. And so that's what he's challenging us to, living a focused life. We ought to be doing fewer things well and stronger and deeper as we get older. And that's my challenge for me. That's what I'm working on. I'm narrowing down. I'm learning how to say no to things and a hearty double yes to other things. People are surprised when I'll say yes to an invitation or to do something or an opportunity or some little job, but it's right in the area that God's calling me to be and to do. And so I get excited about it. And so those are the things that I think we all need to be working on. I was intrigued. Now, those of you who have been around the NAVS for a while will know this one very well. We could probably accumulate quite a few years here. Look at this. Now, just take a look and just see what stops you. You know, remember the old multiplication stories, of course? We used to have them, and those were important. But what intrigues you, and I did this the other day, you know, we're all in the glasses, and so I didn't have my glasses on, and I fixed it so I could see it. I said, I'm sorry, and I fixed it, and then I turned away and I said, is that okay? And everybody said, no, we can't see it at all now. So here we are. What intrigues you about this? What catches you? Of the time is already gone, but only 1.6% of the result has been harvested. The last 98% is in the last 20% of our life. And it's true with pennies that are doubled every day, but it's true with our life. It's powerful. And I watch it constantly. I watch it because I'm looking for it. One of my projects in life is to get the 50-plusers off the golf courses and off the thinking, particularly the 55-plusers, and get back in the ball game. Get back in giving their lives away. Because we have tremendous opportunities, but the ball game has really changed. The rules have changed. A 50-year-old no longer is old. A 60-year-old is no longer old. The latest studies are showing that we have finally a genuine third quarter of life. Third quarter starts right about the end of the 40s and just in the 50s and goes all the way to 70. When my father was growing, moving towards the older years in 50s, by the time he was 55, being a very successful businessman on boards and elder of his church and all the rest, he began to give the jobs over and saying, let the younger ones do it. He was already thinking towards retirement, already thinking towards doing things that would ease him out, set his life up in a whole different way than he was now living it. That's not so today. The 60-year-old is not young, still has lots to do, lots of opportunity. They're physically more active and more fit. And so the third quarter that used to be from 50 to 60 years old, and then we start into retirement, it goes the fourth quarter, the third quarter has now moved out to all the way up to the early 70s. And the fourth quarter, I just looked at a good friend that has looked at his statistics, and he's a life insurance executive. So he's very interested in these kinds of things. And so what he said is, we are looking at you, my being 55, saying, we're looking at you probably with a life expectancy to early 90s. That's a long time. I'm not sure I want to live that long. But anyhow, it's a whole different world. So the time we have to make a productive life, and then, of course, there's always the very sobering fact that most of us, our lives will outlive our support base. So by the time we get into the 70s and 80s, we need to have something there. So we're looking for things to do and things perhaps to generate income even. So there's a lot of challenge out there before us. We cannot stop, and so we need to invest our lives. So it's a challenge to us to look at these and realize that it's coming, but so many times other things take it away from us. We think, boy, I'm not sure I can really do all that. Or, well, that might be true for other people, but maybe not for me. Well, let's just take a look. That first sheet there you have, just very quickly, I'd like to just give some perspective here for the next few minutes. Perspective on how life seems to unfold and where perhaps you not only can invest, but also where we're all going. What's it up to? You know, I chose Joseph's life because it's such a clear life. We can see the end results. He's one of the few that we can follow out. And Joseph was a fascinating individual. And it helps us understand the sovereignty of God developing a life all the way to the end, to the very end. Now, let's just look at a couple of breakdowns of his life. The first part of his life, let's call it the foundations. Foundations of life. And we could carry that out to about age 17. Now, what happened at age 17 that really affected his life? Major event. Sold off, thrown in this well, and sold off to some caravan dealers in his caravan, and on to Egypt they went. And so we learned a lot, though, about him just before that event. We understood that he was 11 of 12. But what was special about him? How would you describe his relationship to his mother? Good? Bad? Special, yeah? He was special. He and Benjamin. Uh-huh. Benjamin was the next one. And special. Why was he special? How about in her dad's eyes? What kind of relationship did he have with his dad? Would you say good? Favored? Got the coat? Got all these different things? How about his relationship with his brothers? Not so good. Would you say it was a dysfunctional family, as we call it today? Very much so. His mother had left, she died, and then he was left to his father, who, as a matter of fact, it wasn't just a coat of many colors, but the coat itself, the outfit he got, was not designed for manual work. So, can you imagine what the 11 older brothers, or the 10 older brothers, were looking at when he... It was just like, you know, someone handing you overalls and then giving him a three-piece suit. And it was just a world of difference. And so here this young man was, very early age, favored, and they were looking to him. And you'd wonder, well, how is this all going to work out in his life? What kind of effect is it going to have? Well, we know a few things. Some things later, we'll come back to it. But a lot of different things in his foundational years set him up. Then at 17, this is the years of a very illustrious part of his career, slave. Slave to whom? Potiphar. What do we know about Potiphar? Much? Delegated a lot. And it was a good thing he did. Because during this particular time as a slave, and probably went to about age 27, he learned an awful lot, didn't he? What did he learn? What did he learn practically?
Management.
Management of what? A whole household. And you can just see how God set him up. He learned management. What did he learn in his own life? Flee temptation, and that was the age 27 experience where he fled, major event in his life. And you see that there's this progressive development. He could have been very bitter, having been sold, sent off, lost everything. What happened to that dream? What happened to what God might have done in his life? Or why did God give him the dream? You could probably remember him sitting there thinking about this. But God, in fact, was doing a work and hadn't left him at all. How do we know God hadn't left him? How did he know? God just profited him. He gave him favor. And apparently he recognized that. And so he recognized this. There was then 27, he took a stand for God, basically. He stood against sin. Potiphar's wife invited him to come into the bedroom with him, and he said, no, I'll not sin against God, and I'll not sin against Potiphar. Potiphar's given me everything in this house, but he didn't give me you. And so you see him stand, and you think, oh boy, now's the time for God to really show him how much he appreciates somebody who takes a stand for him. And he winds up in jail. And so he had a short career here as a prisoner. And then that lasted till about 30 years old. And we see that God is working in his life. Again, we don't see any bitterness there. We don't see him giving up. I'm sure he still wondered about that dream. But then something happened at age 30. The opportunity came. He saw the hand of God in his life. Remember the interpretations of the dream? They came true. That certainly said something to me. So God kept letting little rays of light into this. And then finally, the big opportunity came. And he went to Pharaoh, or the king wanted to have his dream interpreted, and up he went. I remember looking at that and watching how you see, well, what did God, what was he doing there? And here's this great opportunity. And then finally he walks up before the king and he says, I understand you can interpret dreams. And he says, well, yeah, I can. He didn't say that, did he? He said, I can, but God can. And you'd think he'd be ready to just step up and say, well, yeah, I can, but, it might cost you something, king. But he didn't at all. And as a result of his interpretation of the dream, he then became a ruler. And we see what happens. His brothers return and into his life, and it's he goes back and forth with that. Never bitterness towards his brothers. Probably the biggest challenge, as I thought about when he was 30, he might have just turned to the king and say, after he appointed him to be number two, and he says, does that mean everybody in the kingdom reports to me that I'm over everyone? And the king said, well, yeah, I guess that would be. Only myself would be over you. And he said, oh, good. Go get Potiphar's wife. Bring her here. But he never did that. Something happened and developed in his life. Well, when you look at a life like this, and it's important sometimes to look at this, and I've gone all the way through the scriptures and looked at every life possible where you can run it out enough data to make some conclusions. There's some big ones in this one. And you can see that all the way to the very end, God had in store for him something that he himself never saw. But he knew why he was there. He had a sense of destiny very clearly. And he stayed faithful all the way to the end. And he didn't even get become one of the leading of the 12 tribes. His children did, sons. But he had that tremendous sense of destiny all the way to the end. Apparently never stumbled in that sense. But there are a couple things that we need to keep in mind as we move through our lives that really help us understand his life. One thing we can see is that he was developed. This is not your, but you know this. God brings and allows people, events, and circumstances into a person's lives to prepare him or her for his purposes. You saw it in Joseph's life. Constant intervention of people, Potiphar, Potiphar's wife, the jailer, on and on and on. We can name them all. He's constantly doing that. There's circumstances that come into our life. And they just continue to develop. And all through this life, you can see that. And
And you marvel at the way these things happen. And you can see the sovereign God. What was important to him? There's God's part and there's Joseph's part. What was crucial to these people, events, and circumstances? What was crucial here?
Attitude.
Part of that?
Response.
Response. Response is everything. Response is everything. And you all have children, you've watched it, and you look at them now, and you say, boy, it's just so important how you respond. And it's still important how we respond. Absolutely crucial. And events and people and circumstances, be they small or large, will come into our life. And it just, it's so crucial. And to go all the way to the very end. And we'll talk about that, how we transition and move through and to the end, what the end looks like. And how strong that is. Just a quick story, because it's the middle of the day. There was a... I think I've told this to several of you, but it's interesting to us. My third child, a boy, finished West Point, and when he was finishing, he was going into the Corps of Engineers. So that was different than the infantry, which his dad and his older brother, who graduated from Wheaton, and went into the military for some years. So that was infantry, where they have to kind of go through airborne and ranger, these tough courses, you know, but he didn't think he needed to do that. I'll jump out of the airplane, that's fine, well qualified, that's a 3-week course, that's fun. But this ranger course, that's 12 weeks long, and it's really, you know, miserable, and it's tough, and they're not really, Dad, I don't think I really need that, you know. And so we were chatting about it. He says, well, Dad, what do you think? You think I really ought to go? And I said, well, son, you'll never have another opportunity as a 22-year-old to test your limits physically, emotionally, and you'll never have an opportunity to lead people when they haven't slept for 3 days and when they want to go home and it's kind of miserable. Because you see, the first few weeks they're down at Fort Benning, Georgia, then the next few weeks they're in the mountains climbing and rappelling and going on patrols. They keep them in these little 10-man groups. And then they take them for a few weeks out into the desert, and you operate in the desert, stay up and go on 3-day patrols. You don't eat. They, you know, they don't send anything out with you. It's you have to learn how to eat from the land, and you know, it's just tough. And in the last phase, they take you down to the swamps of Florida. And it's always exciting, because if he went into this course, the cycle he would be going through would be the winter phase. So it's in the northern Florida. And when I went through, there was a little thin ice break that we had to chop through, and it wasn't fun. So he says, you know, I'm not sure I need that. I said, well, you probably don't. Well, he got thinking about it, and he decided, I think I'll go. So he signs up for it, and you have to get in great shape, and he is in great shape. He was a triathlon person, so getting through that and qualifying. But of the 150 that they allow to come into each class, only half of those graduate and get this coveted ranger tab on your clothes, and people appreciate that. They admire that. But the risk is, of course, if you don't make it. So off he went. He got married right after graduation. They spent time together, and then he was departed for 12 weeks. Well, everything seemed to be going along well until he got to the very last phase, the swamp phase. And the swamp phase was kind of interesting. And going through this, and people at the end, and you have to pass each one of these phases. And every time you go out in this 10-man group, you're sent on a mission, and you have to accomplish certain things, and they change the leadership. And you're graded each time by this ranger grader that goes along. And so he went, was going along the first 2 weeks, and in the third week, all of a sudden, they're on this big 3-day, kind of a final test. And he was out there for into it, and this one fellow that was leading, this one ranger candidate, was taking them off course. And they were getting lost, and they're wandering through this jungle and swamps, and everybody kind of knew it but the leader. And he wasn't doing well, and finally this ranger grader just pulls them all together and says, "Okay, all right," says, "Ranger so-and-so, you're out as the leader. Ranger Stanley, you're in." He says, "Oh, no, you know, what a time to take over." So he took over and gathered them together, and they were tired and beat, and he says, "Come on, guys, we got to pull it on." So he grabbed one fellow just who's been carrying this big machine gun, says, "Well, we don't even need this machine gun. I don't know why we're even carrying it." He says, "I'll take it, you know," and he took it, and he led the way, and he got them back on course and headed in there, and they're 15 minutes late as they got to the place they're supposed to be, but they went ahead and accomplished their mission. Then they had to go to the shores and get a little rubber boats and paddle a couple miles out to this boat, and all this was done. But when it was finished that time, as the ranger grader gathered them all together, they got back to base camp. He's telling them different things, and so then he said finally, "So here's the results." And he went down the list, and so-and-so, 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 and he got said, "Ranger Stanley, failure." And my son looks. He says, and then he went on and on. So after it was over, he says, "Well, what's the deal? What did they do wrong?" He says, "You missed the objective." He says, "Yeah, but I pull it all together." He says, "No comments, Ranger, my candidate." He said, "You just fail." So he just said, "Oh, boy, I wonder how this is going to affect me." So they're lining up all the remaining ranger candidates. This is the end of the time. His wife, after 12 weeks being gone, and she's on driving down there from New York City, where she was staying for the time, and she's on the way to Fort Benning to watch him at the parade and get his tab. And they are calling out all those who qualified. They call them all out but six, and he was one of the six. So I said, "Would you come over here?" He says, "We've seen in you the capacity to go on. And so for you six, we're giving you an opportunity to go through the last swamp phase again." And they, you know, he looks and he says, "Oh, thanks. You know, this is great." He was mad. He got on the phone. He was talking to my wife. And then I was gone. And so I came back a couple hours later. He called and he says, "Dad, I've never seen anything so unfair. There's going to be guys that'll get this tab that never should. And guys that don't get it that really deserved it." He says, "It's just not fair." I said, "You're absolutely right. It's not fair. It's totally subjective." And I said, "That's just the way life is." He says, "Yeah." He says, "I shouldn't have ever taken this stupid course. Never should have done it." He says, "I told you. I said, I didn't make the decision." He says, "I know." But he says, "You wanted me to go." I said, "Well, I would have liked to have seen you go. And you probably have learned a lot already." He says, "Boy, I'll tell you, I learned I shouldn't have gone." He says, "They can take this ranger tab and throw it, you know." And he was just so aggravated. And I could tell he was almost to the point of tears. So after it was over and he challenged it a little bit, he said, "Well, what do you think, Dad?" I said, "Well, son, it's your decision." He says, "Yeah, I know that." But he says, "What do you think?" I said, "Son, listen to me. This event will come and go in your life. But how you respond to it will affect your life forever." There's a long silence on the end of the phone. He says, "But Dad, I don't want to go back through it." I said, "Son, I'm not saying you should." I said, "But do this. Genesis 37 and following. Read the life of Joseph and then come back and make that decision. And whatever you decide, just make sure it's God's will." So he's okay. So he read Genesis 37, life of Joseph, called back the next morning, said, "Well, I signed up. I'm going back through." I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah. Boy, when I look at Joseph." He says, "Response." Well, he did go back. They made him wait one more week before he joined the next class coming in. But joined the next class, went all the way through it, and he finished up. I remember then, it was about a year later, I was traveling through Germany, so I stopped and saw him. That's where his first assignment was. He came walking back in to the house, and he had his fatigues, his uniforms on, his whatever they call them today, and on there was this ranger tab. So as he walked in, I said to him, "Boy, that ranger tab looks pretty sharp, son." He says, "Oh, yeah." He says, "Yeah, it does." I said, has a lot of meaning, doesn't it? He says, oh, well, yeah, kind of. So his wife left the, she went out into the kitchen, and so he looked at me and he says, Dad, there hasn't been a day of my life, hardly, that I haven't thought about things that I learned going through that course. He says, and if I ever would have quit, it really would have affected my life. Now, that's a little bit more dramatic in one sense, but that's, gee, I hope he's all right. But that's the way it is, and that's the life that we're living. We're moving through life, and transition's going to come, adjustments are going to come, new assignments, places, but our response to it is powerfully important, more important than anything else we can do. And that's why I've watched people go through, and I've done a lot of studies on leaders that made it and didn't make it. And by my calculation, I've compared notes with Bobby Clinton. He's done the same thing. We've looked at all the leaders in the Old Testament, and by our calculation, 15% finished well. A lot of people start. A lot of people do well in the middle, but they don't finish well. And the reason is, they don't make transitions well, and they haven't focused their lives as to what to give the last years of their lives to. And that's absolutely critical. So what I'll be doing here now in the next bit of time, should we take a 5-minute break or 10-minute or what? Is this typical of the of our gang here that as soon as you take a break, it turns into 15, 20 minutes? Okay, let's stand up and move a little bit. Get that, stay right where you are. Now, there's one other thing that, just to get out of Joseph's life. We can see that God brings events, people, and circumstance into our life. But there's also the interesting thing is that affects us forever is where did he get his faith? We never hear much about that. We can only conjecture. Where do you think he got his faith? I mean, he lasted through this, and we know of no other fellowship that he had. He might have had some people, but for some reason we're not given any insight into Scripture as to, you know, like Daniel had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but he didn't. He didn't have anyone else that we know of. What kept him going through?
He learned it from his dad.
Excuse me?
Learned it from his dad.
Think so? No, he got it from his mother before she headed off. Well, there's a lot of ways we could, you know, just conjecture at this point. But one interesting thing about the dad is that he did, he grew up at a time where Jacob, his father, was in the best he ever had been. Remember, he was pretty much of a deceiver all the way through his life. And the older boys, older brothers, that's the part they saw of his life. But in the older years of Jacob, when he had turned back, he had already had the experiences with God, and he walked with a limp. And you can imagine that, 11 or 12-year-old little Joseph looking up and while all his brothers are out with the sheep and say, Dad, what, tell me again, how is it you got that limp? Well, son, I've told you that. I've told you that story. Well, no, there's... How was it? Tell me again, Dad. And so he tells him how he wrestled with him. And what does it mean? And how big was he? And what was it like to really, why didn't you just let go, Dad? And he said, son, I've learned a few things. I've tried to find my way. I've tried to do it my way. And I wanted more than anything else. I wanted God's blessing on my life. And in all different ways I tried. And now that I was hold of God, I wasn't going to let go. Really, Dad? Yeah, son. Whenever you get a hold of God, whatever you hold on to, make sure you hold on to God. Hold on to Him tight. Hold on. And hold on to those dreams, son. that dream that we all kind of laughed about, those two dreams you had, don't forget those. They may be from God. And I bet during those times when he was all alone, he remembered, hang on. Dad said, hang on. But that'll affect you the rest of your life. And one thing I've seen in Joseph's life is what I believe about God will determine what I do and how I live. Right? Isn't that proven through life? And that's what you see at the end of Joseph's life. So we can look at it and look back in his life and say, this man believed in God. Because you can tell it by what he did and how he lived. And so that's the same with us. And it's very important for us to keep that in perspective. Now, you have in the your next page there just a quick look at life here. Let me just go through it very quickly, because it's important to take a perspective when we're going to look at this. Because a lot of transitioning takes place all through our stages of life. And so it's important to understand that. The big question, of course, I imagine quite a few of you have 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds in this room. It's fun, isn't it? Or maybe not really so fun. It's different. It's like with Lauren Sandy, when his last daughter, last child was married, and she was about 30 when she got married, and so we're at the wedding, and I said to Lauren, well, how do you feel? All six are gone now, six are married. Isn't that great? And as you know, Lauren, he stopped, and he thought for a second, and he says, not so sure. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it seemed like when they were around, underfoot and in our house, they did something wrong or had a problem, we could just step in there and deal with it. He says, now we just lay up awake all night just praying and thinking about it. And, you know, I've had those circumstances where I know you have, where they call home and they just dump all the problems and difficulties and all the rest and all on you, and you and your wife or your spouse go, you go into bed and you pray and you keep thinking, you stay up through the night and you keep praying during the night, you wake up and you're just exhausted and wondering what's going on. You call out there and say, well, how's it going? Oh, what? Well, how's it going, what you talked about? Oh, what? Oh, that. Yeah, well, that's okay, sure. Oh, no, you know, you've had to go through that whole thing. Well, that's just the way it is, you know, and you wish you could impart all the things that you've learned at once and let them, so they don't have to go through what we all went through. But they do, don't they? And this is what happens. The big critical question that in the 20-somethings they're going to learn is, who am I? Who am I is a crucial question. If they don't get a hold of that, they're going to struggle. And so are we. It's a dynamic question. All through life, you're going to keep answering that question, because you're going to grow. You're going to develop more things. You're going to understand yourself more. But the basic essence of it should be, we should understand that in the 20s. And that's what they do. And so constantly, you find themselves, the characteristics of it, and I won't write all these things down, but they're questioning. They're exploring. They're looking for purpose. They're watching. They're verifying values. And that's so important to them. They push off. They push off on you. They've got to get some space. They've got to try things. And it's a little bit scary today, because some of the things they try have greater consequences than they did when we were out there. When I went through high school, the real bad guy was a guy who drank a beer. And now that's nothing. And we know that one list step in the wrong direction can have great consequences, even if it was somewhat naive. And so our role is a stronger one. And even as grandparents, we're finding, and you are too as well, the great role that you play in the 20-somethings. I'm finding that grandparents are playing bigger roles in 20-year-olds today than some of their parents are, in terms of establishing who they are and what their values are. And I go on that. There's a lot of study and research on that. But they respond more to our value commitments, the 20-year-olds, than do the 30- and 40-year-olds. And they look at the 30- and 40-year-olds, what's called the boomers, and say, whatever they did is not what I want done. I don't like their values. It's the me generation. They don't like it. And so the 20-year-olds is the first group that has ever grown up into adulthood that has been the latchkey group. They have more knowledge and understanding than, of course, we do, and that's logical in one sense. But the computer age, your kids like mine, when they were 15 and 14, they were operating a computer like I'd had to go to my 13-year-old son to get, you know, when I'd make something, a mistake, and he'd fix it for me. And I'd ask him, well, now, what did you do so next time I can fix it? He said, Dad, don't bother. I'll just call me. You couldn't understand it, he says. I mean, it's very intimidating. But they're hungry. I remember when my one son was at Wheaton, and his junior and senior year, he brought about 6-7 guys home, buddies. And they didn't want to go out on their own. What they wanted to do, because 5 of those 7 didn't have Christian parents, most of them were divorced, and they wanted to hang around us. And we were ready to go to bed, and, you know, 11 o'clock, we're ready to hang it up, and we're going up, and they said, well, couldn't you just talk a little bit more? And we just thought, this is amazing. We got up in bed, and we just kind of, you know, just, you're just worn out. And of course, breakfast was nice because we were alone at breakfast. The 20-year-olds don't get up early for breakfast. But we do. We still get up early, and, you know, it's just great. But 20-year-olds, key to the future, very inquiring, establishing themselves, understanding who they are. And look down where it says the greatest danger. They need to understand, they get exposure and evaluated feedback. Most 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and actually others, I ask, feedback. What's feedback? It's taking their experience and giving them some comment about it. You know, the 20-year-old and 30-year-old, for that matter, is not that interested in what you and I think. But they are very interested in what you think about what they think. Aren't they? And that's really true. And so you got to let them talk and you got to let them go on and then we give feedback. Our young staff desperately need this. They don't understand basic principles like the basic principle that came out of Genesis 1:28. To rule, subdue, and bring all things under management to a point where you bring it to fruitfulness. Now that's a basic command that we're given, and it should affect all of our jobs. But most of us will grow up with parents and Boy Scouts and all the rest and around where that was honored. They didn't put a verse to it. And we used to call it the work ethic, or we'd call it, well, that's the Germans. The Germans do that. I had a 36-year-old guy. We just built a house, and he came and he did all the framework. Big, strapping guy, blonde, blue eyes, and just put that thing together with only one assistant. And everything was lined up perfectly. And I was talking to the drywaller the next day, or a couple weeks later, as he was putting. He says, "Who did your framing?" And I said, "Well, a guy named Ed." He says, "He did a fantastic job. Look at this." And he took this big drywall piece and slid it up to the top, and it was perfect. But then he says, "Watch this." And he slid it over to the wall, and it was perfect on the wall. He says, "I'll tell you, I've been in this business 18 years, and I could put on a hand the houses that I could do that with." Well, it's back to this basic principle. But they haven't learned to take responsibility for what is given to them and then bring it under control to the point it's brought to fruitfulness. That's not a management idea. That was God's idea from the very beginning. That's how we operate. And so we see these things develop, and these 20-year-olds are crucial to us. And what's really important to them down here is that they be faithful. Faithful in what they're done, just like Joseph. Faithful, whether you're a slave, whether you're a prisoner, you're faithful, and you'll learn. Now, the thing that I want to tell you about, just to take a note of that, is just no mentors. Very few mentors. What decisions will 20-year-olds be making that are crucial for their life? Marriage, occupation, schooling, cars, you know, big things. Now, what about their peers? Can they help at this point? How does a 20-year-old view a peer? someone they hang out with. Do they view them as a repository of wisdom? No, nothing. But that's the only one input most of them have, is their peers. Or something else. So it's absolutely crucial they have mentors that have gone before them, because they're making some of these crucial decisions. Little concentration on inner life, impact of dysfunctional family, we could go on a lot. So what they need is a framework. They need a framework for decisions. And they're building that. But they need interaction with people like you and me and others to get that framework. They need feedback. They need exposure. They need experiences. And they need mentors. Mentors are absolutely crucial. You know what mentoring of one particular, not only one who will give them feedback and help them interact over their decisions and their thinking, but they desperately need models. Modeling mentors. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Because they're dying to know, is there anybody out there who has been faithful to God in business, coaching, teachers, whatever it is? They're wanting to know, are there people that have gone before me who have been faithful to it? Can you really live the Christian life as a business person, as this person or mom or dad, whatever it is? Can it really be done? And they're asking themselves these questions. I met an executive or a person who was involved in executive hunting, a headhunter for placement, particularly of 20-year-olds. And so I asked him, what kind of questions do you ask of the 20-year-olds? So he told me several of them. And one of them, he said, I asked them, who are your heroes? And when I asked, after he mentioned that, I said, boy, that'd be interesting. What kind of feedback you get? He says, unfortunately, very little. I said, like what? He says, what do they tell you? He says, they don't have any, or they can't think of any, or too many, or what? He says, no, they don't have any. They've all been disillusioned. There might be a few out there. And so models are absolutely crucial. 20-year-olds need to be reading books about mentors, about models, about people who have gone before us. But they need you and me. They need to see it in life. And so this is the 20-year-old. They're cynical. They're skeptical about this. And so spending a little time there too, because I know a lot of you have them, either grandchildren or your own children. Well, then the other crucial phase, of course, the 30 to up through 50, is what I call the contributing years. And the big question there is, what do I do? You think that that question, of course, is answered or is certainly asked in the teenager and even in the 20s, but now it's getting serious. They want to know, what do I do? Because these are the contributing years. The 30-year-old is the 30-year time is the most pressured time you'll ever experience in your life. Can you remember those 30s? They were wild, weren't they? They are under a lot of pressure. Family gets growing. They expect you to do something. It's just like in the military. You know, when I got in, I was a second lieutenant. They gave me a brown bar. And I was so embarrassed to wear that. And even the enlisted men were embarrassed a little bit. They had to salute me. But there was always kind of a, well, he'll learn someday. We'll salute him for the future anyhow. You know, you don't know anything. So it's, you're walking around, you're an apprentice. Then I got a little silver bar. And the silver bar said, well, he's been around for 18 months. He might know something. And so you're treated with a little bit more acceptance and respect. But then I actually got two silver bars, and that was a captain. And I noticed there was a whole different spirit about it, but also there's a different attitude and expectation. Before, they didn't expect much out of me, but now they did. And that's just like the 30-year-olds. So in business, wherever you are, they expect more out of a 30-year-old. He knows something. She knows something. She's done some things. And so it's very important. And so 30-year-old is a pressured time. And what happens here in the 40s is something very interesting around that period. And the reason it's interesting is because your paradigm begins to shift. And there's some very honest things that come up. Some experts call it the time of second thoughts. Am I in the right place? I'm in the right job. And you begin, and the reason is because you move your your point of reference from the rear, from birth to the fore ahead of you, death. And it isn't like you become morbid, but you suddenly realize you may have less years in front of you than you've got behind you. And I better make them count. There's a sense of importance and of meaning. And so that's what they do. And so they begin to have second thoughts sometime in the 40s. And we all have them. Some go into a rather traumatic experience about it, and they call that midlife crisis. But it need not be. But that 30 and 40-year-old, you're trying to not only earn a living, but make a place in the world among those who you respect. If you're with the navigators, you want to get to a place where other navigators respect you, accept you as one of them. You've made your mark. You've stepped in and you're part of us. Or it could be whatever else you're into. But in the navigators, it's especially important as well, because we are somewhat of a family. We are, we hold certain things as valuable. And so you'll find navigator staff working hard in their 30s to get a nod. You've made it. You're part of us. But it's also a time where some of the investments and decisions you made earlier in life come to fruition in the 40s. So if you didn't really do a few things right, maybe, or wrong about your career, about your family, or whatever it may, you might have thought, whatever the result is comes back in. And it's sobering time. This I would say for some of you, and this is why I'm going over it, it's very important to mentor people through this time. And you can do it. It does not require psychology. It requires an older brother or sister. Let me speak to the women. Coming out of the 40s, into the 50s, what's happening to most moms? Working, but why? Kids are gone. And most of them, that didn't happen so much in our age, where, you know, the wives didn't work so much, but today, the 30 and 40-year-olds, working, it's part of it. As soon as they get out of college, get out of the child raising, or the kids get older, they're into the marketplace. Nothing wrong with it. But it's a whole new dynamic. And some of them are breaking back out into a time, and they're suddenly where a lot of their peers had been out there, and they've been faithful in the home, they've been watching the kids, they've been there, they've been doing the things that we've encouraged and affirmed, and we feel the Bible would give that priority of commitment, and suddenly they get out into a world that hasn't responded to that commitment, and many of them have moved ahead, and they'll find themselves sometimes behind and get very, very insecure. So they come out there, and they don't know where to start, how to get caught up. They feel they're behind in ministry, behind in the techniques that perhaps the husband has worked on, and he's gone off to different places and he's learned about them, but the wife hasn't. And the solution is not to go back home. The solution is to walk through it and help that person find their who they are and what they have at this point. It's a transition time. There are many transition times, but this is one of the most important of our adult life. When the children finish and stepping into, they're still around, or not even finished, but maybe they're finishing, they're getting older, they're more independent. These are transition periods. And we'll watch people go through this, and you've gone through it. And because you've gone through it, you have so much to offer. And more than advice is they need someone to walk with them, to pray with them, to believe in them. And that will make an awful lot of difference in their life. And so the 40s goes up to the 50s. As I mentioned down here, the characteristic or the prime ingredient, of course, is the critical is the stewardship, being faithful to that which God has given you. But we lose the perspective on that, and that's where it's so crucial to have a mentor, someone older. You look at the greatest dangers. There are a number of them there, not developing inner life. But the two that I would point out here are dabbling and plateauing. Easy to do. And it's easy to do later in life, too, and that's why I like to mention it. Dabbling means doing a little bit of everything. We in the navigators, as I've watched a lot of staff and talked to a lot of them, we tend to be generalist, which is good. We can do a lot of things. We do evangelism, do a little this, do a little that. But as we get older, along with the generalist idea, we need to have a more clear understanding of what our gifting is and what our strength is. What has God been doing in you and me? What is the message you have to give to the generation behind you? When you're given a free time at the table, sitting around, wherever it is, what is it you want to talk about? I find this, that the message that's within you has been created in a special way. It's through your successes in ministry and life, whatever it is, you're given a platform. But it's through your valleys that you form your message. And God works that way. And if we were to sit Joseph down here this morning and sit him down and say, Joseph, what do you have to tell us? He'd say, he wouldn't start saying, I said, you know, if we only have a half hour to talk to these people who are really important people, what are you going to tell them? He wouldn't say, well, boy, let me tell you about what it was like to be number two in the kingdom. I mean, I had chariots, I had things, I could say this, and he wouldn't say that. What would he tell us? He'd say, stay close to God, whatever the cost. He'd tell us about what it's like to walk through struggles, disappointed dreams, difficulties. That's what the 20 and 30 year olds needs to hear. And that's the message that's been forming in you. You need to take time to put it together. You need to take time to think about it. Because as you think about it, it's going to be right there, but develop it. Work through it. Know how to communicate it to others. It's your life message. It'll come in many ways, many places. It's not often preached. It's just lived out. It's prayed out. It's prayed for. And so these are very important years. And we need to overcome that. And dabbling takes place when we're really not clear of what our contribution and focus is. So we do a little bit of everything. It's like the person who's coming out, and I was met somebody, he's 42 years old, and we're chatting, and a staff person. I said, what are you good at? He says, well, I don't know, a little bit of everything. I said, like what? So what have you been doing the last few years? Because he was confused, and he was trying to help ask me to get some information. I said, how about evangelism? Well, I do a little this and a little that, but not real good at evangelism. Oh, well, then developing and building people up, and what we call equipping. Well, it's, yeah, I do that. I do it well. Well, how about real well? Well, not so real well. I mean, there are other guys who do it real well. Like who? And told me a couple. So, how about leadership? Yeah, I've led a few things. Would you say leadership's your strength? No, I wouldn't say that. How about, and we were going down the list. Teaching. You like to teach. It just wasn't coming. And so this person was then kind of committed to just do a little of everything. He couldn't focus anything. And it didn't help him to determine what development ideas he might want to take on. He was thinking of going to seminary because he didn't have anything else to do. And we'll find a lot of people there, and what they need is affirmation. I saw this. I've watched you. You're good at this. God blesses. Last night I had a perfect illustration of this as doing what you're when you find your thing. I don't know whether you've ever heard this fellow, the Acts chapter 2, the group, as a three-man group. Well, the lead, the male singer, the only male, there are two brother and two sisters. He sang at our church last night. Fantastic voice. And in such a way, when the kinds of songs he sang, there was such tremendous sense of worship when he sang. People were moved to God. I mean, I've been around very few singers like that. And just he sings it out and his heart is there. But in between the songs, somebody has told him that he needs to talk. And he started to talk a lot and he was terrible. And I thought, when he sang, he blessed. When he talked, he wasted our time. He was trying to bring some spiritual thoughts and he's trying to bring a little bit funny and lighten it. And every time he did, I mean, people would look at each other and you almost want to go up there and say, hey, pal, don't talk, just sing. Well, we need to find out and help people find what singing is, what their singing is, what you're good at. I should know not to say that with Bob Lovren and the group. Okay, don't sing. I won't sing. Plateauing. We know what that is. We are dealing with that on a nationwide basis. Many of our established, strong countries of our whole global society are plateauing. They're leveling off. They're not as fruitful as they were before. But they've mastered or they've garnered enough momentum in their ministry to bring them through and carry them through and keep them going. We've got to find ways to bring new life, renewal, and focus on and that again. But that happens with people as well. You know you're not doing, you're plateauing when some of the areas that you're very good at, you just don't have energy for. And if that's true, you know you're plateauing. You're not excited about things. You're not learning. One of the comments that I was talking to some 20, 30-year-old staff, and they're saying, "Where are the mentors? We want mentoring. Where are they?" And I said, "Well, you've got older staff." They said, "Well, I'm around two of them, and they haven't been learning at all. I want somebody who's learning, somebody's alive." Doesn't mean you have to go learn the computer, but you're learning about life. You're fresh. There's still new ideas. We're not talking all the time about the history. We're checking. We're moving into areas. We're pressing on. We've got to keep developing, keep growing. My mother, who's 91 years old, she visits the old folks' home all the time, take care of those old people, and she keeps going. And so about 10 years ago, they offered her a chance to go. The senior citizens were going to have a Bible study, and so they had this Bible study, and she went. And so I knew she was going, and I said, "Well, Mom," after she came back, I guess a couple of days later, I said, "How'd it go?" She says, "Oh, it was nice, but I don't want to go there." And I said, "Well, why?" She says, "Oh, they just talk." I said, "Well, isn't that nice?" She says, "No, they don't want to learn. I want to study the Bible." So I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" I said, I do know as a good friend, we had led this couple to Christ and they lived near her. And one of them, she's a leader in the community Bible studies. So I said, "Mom, there's one, but it's a demand." And this was 5 years ago. And she said, "Well, give me the address or give me the phone number." She called them up. And a couple weeks later, I talked to her and she's there. She says, "Now that's my kind of group." And she's got this big double with her glasses and got this big bold print or whatever it is. And she does her study, takes her hours to do it, loves it. And she's fresh. You can always talk to her. She's got something to talk to you about God. Always fresh. And we need to be pushing into other areas. We cannot stop learning. So what's your learning way? How do you learn? Do you learn through books, observing, watching, hearing other people, talking to people, watching, experiencing? All those are beautiful learning gates. Reading is not the only place. But find them and pursue them and keep going, because that's going to make you the mentor people want to be around and want to draw more from. So plateauing. Okay. Then finally we get into yours, investing. And here we're talking about the big question is in who, in whom, and in what. These are the crucial years of investing. And naturally, of course, we, especially as navigators, don't need to be told we're investing back in the generations behind us. But the characteristics of this phase of our life ought to be very focused. As I said before, the older we get, the more focused we should be. We have so much to give, so much to give. But somehow the world keeps telling us we don't. And that happens because you talk to people and you might have children that are learning so fast. The 40-year-olds, you know, the 30-year-olds, I mean, they know so much more than I know. We can be very intimidated. But the fact is, what they know is not what they need to know from you. What they know, what they need is life. They need insights. They need feedback. They need affirmation. They need prayer. They need somebody who'll just be with them. And somehow we've been talked into this idea that we don't have it. Or, you know, you've got to be a teacher to mentor. You know, sit down. You've got to have it all together. Throw that away. It's wrong. It's a myth. All you need to do is be who God has made you to be and give what you've got. You've got so much. I was at one of my supporting churches out in the New Jersey area. We arranged to do something, and I'd right after this, my book on connecting, Bobby and I's book on connecting came out. So they said, could you come and do something like that on mentoring? And I said, sure. So we had a Friday night and a Saturday morning, ended with lunch, had a great time with this bunch. They had about 90, and we talked to them. And after it was over, there were 10 elders. The pastor says, let's just have a little time to get feedback and interact, evaluate. So we sat in this one room after the lunch, and everybody had gone home. So here are these 10 elders, and he's got a pastor and two young pastors. And so he says, Paul doesn't need the affirmation. Let's not go around and say, great job and all the rest. Let's just go around. How did it affect you? How did it affect you? So we're moving through, and we got to this one young pastor. He was head of the youth, 24 years old, two small kids, married and two small kids. And he's got his head down, and he looks up, and he's got tears coming out of his eyes and says, I desperately need a mentor. He said, my mom and dad just separated when I was 12. My dad was a drunkard. He kept coming, and at 16 years old, I decked my dad and almost beat him to death because he beat my mom, and I kicked him out of the house. I said, if you come back in, Dad, one more time in this house, you will not go out live. And he said, my dad believed me, and he went away. I don't know what it's like to be a dad. I don't know what it's like to be a husband. I've got two kids. I find myself yelling when I shouldn't yell, just like my dad. I don't know. Somebody helped me through high school, and then they gave me a scholarship to Bible school. Went through there, met my wife, and we just need help. We've been married 5 years. Two kids. I need a mentor. Now, having just talked about mentoring, and here a lot of the older elders, what do you think I was expecting? I thought I'd have to run over and protect this guy from about six people. Say, I'll get him, I'll get him, I'll get him. No, I want him. What happened was the typical thing. I looked around and everybody went, looked down. There was a 65-year-old guy over there. I'd gotten to know him. Has a terrific family. Raised five kids, seen his wife. They're walking with the Lord. I looked at Elmer like this. And I'm going to go. So after it was over, we went on. I went back to Elmer and said, Elmer, you could help that young man. He said, oh, I couldn't. I couldn't help him. I said, what do you mean? You've raised five kids. Oh, grace of God. All the grace of God. I said, but you were involved in that. You did some things. You made some mistakes. Oh, yes, I did. I made lots of mistakes. I couldn't. No, I said, but Elmer, who else is going to do it? Well, I don't know. I'll pray. I'll pray for him. I said, Elmer. Now, this guy was not a shy person. He was the CEO of a company. He had done all this, but somehow believed he couldn't do this. So I said, Elmer, do this. Would you go and buy this book? And I gave him the name of it. It's a family, developing families. And take the book, buy two copies. Go and give that young man one. And say, if you read the first chapter, I'll read the first chapter. We'll meet together for breakfast and talk about it. Would you do that? He said, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. I said, you don't have to say anything. Just talk about what you read. So he said, okay. So he did. And I said, by the way, Elmer, tell him take all the disclaimers you can tell him. Tell him what a bad dad you were, and it was all grace, and you don't have anything to say, and you're not a good teacher. I said, you just feel free to tell him all that. Well, okay. Anyhow, 2 months later, I just happened to think of Elmer, and I gave him a phone call. Got a hold of him. I said, Elmer, how's it going? Oh, fine. Going great. I said, no, how's it going with this young pastor? He says, well, I wish I could help him more. I don't know. I said, well, Elmer, what's happening? Are you still meeting and still reading the book? He says, oh, yes. We meet and we've had him over several weekends as a family. And I don't know whether I'm helping him very much. I said, I'm sure you are. Keep it up. Hung up. Pick up the phone. Dial the church. Got a hold of the pastor. Young pastor. I said, hey, how's it going with Elmer? Oh, you mean Grandma and Grandpa? He said, oh, what a blessing. He says, I don't even read the book anymore. He doesn't know, though. I don't tell him that. He says, but we sit down at breakfast, and I just start asking questions. And he always starts it off and say, well, I made a lot of mistakes in Sarah, but here's something. And he goes on. Well, 1 year later, this couple is a new couple. God's blessing them, and they're having their third child. Because somebody got in there and stopped believing the lie that you have nothing to give. There are staff out there struggling with marriages. You know, these kids have come to know Christ. They have no background. They didn't have Christian parents. You know, the chance of them making it in life is really a struggle. They get up under with finances. They get places that they haven't been before. They're people looking to them to do things and provide answers that they don't feel themselves they can do. They're part of the beautiful people. They've grown up and they look so sharp. You bring them up here and say, boy, look at those sharp ones. IBM would love to have them. And IBM probably would love to have them. But they've made a choice to come with the Navigators. But boy, the demands of life and the struggles when they're contemporaries. When I went full-time in ministry after stepping out of military career, my church, boy, they were so behind me. People would say, it was the 70s, early 70s when everybody was going full-time. Pat on the back, noble thing to do. Now even their parents that are Christians are wondering, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And so they need you. They need mentors. And they need mentors of all kinds. I could tell you lots more stories about how people got involved in them. Just calling up one staff, older staff person said, I've heard you and I understand this, but I don't know what I even have to offer. I said, would you do this? There's another couple I know about that's, just not far from you. They're young. Would you just call them up or drop by or somehow and just ask them, the Lord's laid on my heart to pray for you on a regular basis. Could you give me a few things to pray about? And just see where it goes. But keep coming back each week. Tell them what get updates. He did that, and I talked to him some months later. He says, we've got a tremendous relationship going. You see, they don't need insights in how to do ministry, but they need insights in how to live life, how to raise kids, how to walk with God in tough circumstances. They do need that desperately. And so this is what's important, and these are the investing years. But you see down there under the dangers, let me just put the key word here. Key word. Generosity. Giving life away. Giving what you've got. And the passage there, of course, is Christ who was so wealthy. Gave it all away that we who are poor might become wealthy. And that's what we really need to be thinking about. But there are two things that, we are all concerned with. One is finishing well. And two is leaving a legacy. And that's very important. And those are two subjects we could spend a lot of time with. We won't turn to it right now, but in the very back of your book is the essence of what Bobby Clinton and I decided to make a study on who finishes well. And so we went through a lot of people, of those who finished well, those who didn't, historical characters and people and in the Bible, outside the Bible, Christians that we knew. And these are the elements of five elements of those who finished well had present in their lives. And so we thought we'd just pass that on to you. And I'm sure I won't get a chance to talk about that, but another time. So that's it. That's the. Let's just take another little five-minute stand. And I just have a few more things I want to share with you about the actual mentoring, the practical side of it. So let's just stand up and take five.
When you finish this.
Okay, let me just take you through a real fast exposure of some mentoring. Now, I've spent the last 2 years looking at Jesus Christ, the leader developer, and just some fascinating things in watching him. And I'm sure you've all done some study. I'd love to hear if you have, because I'm trying to understand him. And of course, Jesus had a very specific task to train the 12, and also it was good to look at other great mentors. To me, some of the great mentors, aside from Jesus Christ, particularly in the New Testament, are Paul, but also Barnabas. And they just offer so much to understand mentoring. But just let me just go down quickly, just to give you, if you're interested in some of this, to get you into some study that perhaps you could send me your way. But this is a time to really look into mentoring. But the foundation, and like I said, if you want it, we'll just type it. Don't send you a copy. It'll be too much. You'll lose the points here if you try to copy it all down. Foundation of Jesus mentoring the 12. One is total obedience to God. That just connected him to God. He was a channel. And that's just, you know, one of those deep things. Obedience and love were those two deep core issues that one needs to build into a person's life or have God work in that area. But his anointing was anointed. His deep love for his followers. Tremendous love for his followers. I mean, they just, you look at Peter even at the end where he failed him and he reinstated him. But just you see it all during the time. It just seemed like his disappointment was never expressed in that way. If they did wrong, he would get after him, or if they, whatever. But you never saw him. Just had a tremendous love. And this came from real intercession with them, praying for them. Tremendous thing. It has been very challenging for me just in my own fathering of our adult children and our grandchildren. His trust in God's work in them. Tremendous trust, and he really believed him. You know, I just suddenly saw that when he was teaching the parable, the Sermon on the Mountain, and he turned to them and he said, "You are the light of the world. You are salt." Do you know what their spiritual state was when he said that to them? I mean, they're still degenerate. They were degenerate people. They didn't, the Spirit of God had dwelt in them. And yet he saw something in them. He says, "You're light. You're light and you're salt. You'll be the salt." He believed in him. He trusted God's work in them. God's going to do a work and you yourself won't even believe. And so it was challenging for him. His transparent withness. Sorry for the awkward word withness, but they were with him all the time. But he was transparent. You know, Leighton Ford and I have worked together for a number of years now trying to pull together a leader program for younger leaders, 30-year-olds, particularly aiming at those. And he's developed this Arrow program, and we've worked together on that. And one part of it is to promise, it's a 2-year program, it's to promise these people that come, they'll give them a mentor if they can't get one themselves. And do you know that these young guys are all in their 30s, we have some young women as well, they are eager as can be to be involved in this. And he, Leighton Ford being Leighton Ford, he gets some of the best that will come in and speak. And you know, it's really impressive that the things they hear. But you know what, when they surveyed him as to why you joined the program, you know what their number one reason was? To get a mentor. To get a mentor. And so we spend time talking about that. So I said to Leighton, the hardest thing you're going to find is getting a mentor. Getting a mentor for these people. He says, "Oh, I know all kinds of them." And he does. So he gathered a list of all these, the 60 and 70-year-olds that he knew that were out there and now had more time. I mean, all the way from my memory.
Senior moment.
It's just, it's just like Phyllis and I were laughing the other day that some person asked him, he saw a couple that were retiring. He said, "Well, what do you do? What do you do in your retirement time?" He says, "We just look for things." True, isn't it, huh? Spend most of our time looking for things. Ted Engstrom. It always comes back. Ted Engstrom was on this list and all these others. Okay. And he even wrote a book. Actually, someone wrote it for him, but on mentoring. And he had so much. And so this person said, "Listen, just talk to me and I'll write it." And he did. And it's a good book. But so we get in there and I said, "Leighton, these people will not sign on." So sure enough, he wrote to them all, his own stationery, everything else, invited them to be part of investing into the future generation of leaders in the evangelical world in the United States. How many of you think said, "Sign me up"? Very, very few. Only about 25%. He couldn't believe it. He called me up. We talked about it. I said, "Listen, let's take the fear away. Let's offer a quick course, a kind of a crash course on mentoring. These guys got it all. We just got to get them to get it out. They're going to die with all that God gives them. Take it with them. We don't want them to do that." So we did this thing. We're different cities around the country. Thursday night, they flew in about late afternoon. We met at supper Thursday night and then went through all of Friday, and they left at 4:30 on Friday. So it fit. And it was a short course on mentoring. I tell you, it was so much fun. I mean, I haven't had so much fun in my life. The first thing I did with them right after supper was to sit down, and you had to identify a mentor when you were under 30 and tell about that person, what contribution they make your life into your life, etc., and then a mentor after 30. And it was, they sat around. I mean, we were supposed to only take an hour and a half for this, but the sharing, we went into 11 o'clock at night. I mean, they're listening to each other's stories. I mean, these were out of history books that you're hearing. Who marked my God? You know, one guy gave his life over in Japan. And he was at Wheaton, and some guy came along and was a tremendous speaker. And with all the Wheaton students there, said to him, I'm going to pray all during this week while I'm here speaking. I'm going to be praying for Asia. But I'll pray for the world while I'm here. Anybody want to join me can join me. And there are only three who joined them. And all three wound up giving their lives in Asia. 21 years old, praying. He says, we got down on our knees, and I mean, it was powerful. I mean, it was just, you know, these are things what our people, no, I don't want to get into preaching. Anyhow, the reason I was mentioning this to you. See, there was a reason. Can anybody think of the reason that I, It'll come. That's when the idea is, if the 50s, eventually it comes back, you know. I'm told when you get the 60s, it's lost. So. Yeah.
I'm a retired speaker since
Thank you. Oh, right. Oh, thank you very much. That's got it. Transparency. All right. So there's one guy who's been vice president of World Vision. He's done all kinds of things. And he was there sharing his life. And then one fellow who was Don Hoke, if you ever know that name. He comes up, and of course he's in his 70s. And so Don says, you know, one thing that's challenged me, he says, I've got to be transparent with my life. And I've got to let these younger ones just see my real life and even my failures. And this guy who was the former vice president was about his same age. He says, Don, they've been seeing your failures for years. It's just a matter of owning up and to use them to actually to help develop someone else. But see, the transparency is so crucial. But some people are absolutely afraid to be transparent. And if we are, we'll never make it. Jesus was so transparent. And finally, primary concern was for character, development of character. And it doesn't mean you need to go in and develop the character. You need to help God, just kind of co-labor with God in the development of character. And we all know at this point in our life, we don't develop character in anybody. God is the one, but we can participate. It's a very spiritual job of mentoring. Spending time praying, God, where are you at work? What are you doing that I can be part of? And that's important. So that's just a look at him. And just to show you how... just the different things. Let me just run down them very quickly. That Jesus and his mentoring technique approach was very relational and very informal. Very rarely anything formal, if at all. It was an oral approach, interactive, always talking, very mobile, underway, going. Doesn't need to be in just one place. It can be anywhere. He models. He modeled what he was committed to. He taught. He taught in different situations. He would gather them together. Always the teaching moment that he just picked up. And he enabled practical application. He gave them jobs, sent them out by two. He gave them something to do, to think about. When they came back, he debriefed. Remember, experience is not the best teacher. Never was and never is. The best teacher is evaluated experience. There are people walking out around here all over the place, including your children, that have lots of experience. But because no one's ever taken the time to evaluate it with them, they haven't learned much from it. They'll learn much from some areas. But that's the power of feedback. And that could be a whole other session, because just sitting down with someone and helping them talk about what they've experienced themselves. was with a NAV staff couple just a little bit ago, and they're talking about their marriage. I said, what's the one thing this year you want to see change? They said, our marriage. It didn't look like a bad marriage. So I said, well, you want me to give you some feedback and interaction on that? They said, have you watched us? I said, no. I said, let's just take an hour. And so we just sat down. I said, tell me what you'd like your marriage to be, ultimately. Just describe it. Do you mind if I take notes? No. Okay. They described it. We put down a few things and got to about 6-7 things. We talked about and what it looked like. I said, now, in light of that, how you doing? Where are you in this? Where are you in that? And so we identified. And I said, so it looks like these three are the ones that you're struggling the most with. Yeah. Well, where can we start? What efforts have you tried to make to get there? So let's take this one. And we talked about it. They told me what they were doing. I fed in a few more things. We made some other suggestions. At the end of our time, I connected them with a couple that lived near them to get them going on developing. It took me an hour. That's all you need to do. Just start with a reference point. They need to start, let them figure out what they really want it to be. Done that with navigator jobs. We find navigators all over have never had their job evaluated or reviewed. They don't. It doesn't happen. But if you can say, listen, how'd it go last year? Oh, all right. Well, what did you start out with? What did you want to see happen last year? Well, it was this or that. And what else? What else do you want to see in this area, in that area? Okay, how'd it go? What happened in this area? You know, on a case of 1 to 10, how'd you, 10 being the best, what did you get? Well, we got about a 6. What happened? What happened? We get into this and we talk about it. If you could run the videotape back of last year and run it all new, what would you do differently to make a change? And they'll tell me some things. You finish an hour, hour and a half with somebody, you've had a great time of interaction, you walk away and they say, boy, thanks. This helped. Give them something to go with. And see, that starts a mentoring relationship. So, enable practical application. He encouraged. He corrected. He stressed the indispensability of divine empowerment. So, we have the models out there of all this. Now, I'll show you this when M.K. King is a head of a consultancy on mentoring. But he's basically made the comment, he's a real expert, that there's only one way to develop leaders, and that's mentoring. But read this. This is interesting. When exercising a mentoring role, the leader essentially operates as a facilitator. In order to further the full release of the mentoree's personality and talents, he seeks to holistically impact the mentoree through the totality of the shared life. It is precisely this influencing of the whole being that no course, no seminary, no book can satisfy. It takes life. It takes experience. It takes contact with a human soul. It takes example. It takes emulation. It takes mentoring. I do not know whether this man is a Christian or not. Powerful. I mean, if we really want to see that happening, pray for mentors for your kids. Pray for people. And, you know, it's just there. Now, just from you, when you think of an effective mentor, I'd like to have you turn either in twos or threes. Don't move a whole bunch. Just talk. You've got 1 minute to come up with just 2 or 3 points of what an effective mentor is. Go. What are the characteristics of effective mentor? Characteristics. Okay, turn around. Let's hear some highlights, some individual ones. This This group down here was really intense. Let's hear one of yours. Jim, what was one? Did anybody say anything wise there? Okay. Experience in the field? Okay. Experience in the area that he's going to mentor. Very good. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. He believes in me. All right. What do you mean? Believes. Okay. Uh-huh. Good. Very good. Okay. Believe that I can do it. What else? Over here.
Willing to listen.
Willing to listen. Boy, that's true. Mentors. Somebody asked me, who makes a good mentor? And I told them, for every 10 inquiries or interactions, 9 should be questions and 1 should be statements. If you're going to be a good mentor, you've got to learn to listen and ask good questions. You know, and good questions will come. I am not a good question asker. And I've had to really work at developing it. My wife has helped me tremendously because I'm the type that has always got something to say. And so, you know, I'm waiting to. So about 15 years ago, my wife really helped me with that, and I really worked at it. And so when I switch into that mode, it makes a whole difference. Genuine concern about for the person himself. Okay. You, yes.
Real love and care for the person. I have you in my heart.
Great. Okay. Love and care. Yes. Harry. Save the relationship. There's some confidentiality. Okay. Very good. Okay.
I think another one is good. Willing to do the work. I think of some of the guys you mentioned there about, I would imagine they were not willing to put forth the effort to be a mentor.
It's going to cost. Yeah. It's going to cost. Chuck? Well, that's a big one. That's a real big one. Most of my people have, you know, we've interacted, and they'll say, well, what about navigators? I mean, they've given their life to the Paul Timothy and raising up others to mentoring. Shouldn't they be good mentors? And I said, no, a lot of them are not good mentors when they get older. Why?
Their agenda.
And they're so confined to the Paul Timothy type relationship, they don't understand the Barnabas relationship. Barnabas is more of the coach guy. Come alongside. That's the kind of thing that younger people need in that way. You will get the Paul Timothys. I mean, people like you will get those, and go get them when you got them. But a lot of them, we need to shift and become, expand our repertoire of mentoring skills to include the Barnabas types, where we come alongside, we encourage, we listen, we be there when they need it, and let them set the agenda, which is really crucial. Yes. Good. Transparency, including failures. Yes. That's absolutely. So the agenda becomes what God's doing with you, and also the mentoree. It's his or she's agenda. She drives it. Good. That's really great. Well, I'm not going to share mine. That's really good. Let me just get here. You have on the one sheet this here. It's the constellation model. You'll see it. This is what we came up in the book. And the reason for this, I just wanted to make a key point, is all these little men there, what they represent is different kinds of mentoring. And you can see down there below, it talks about the thrust of mentoring, little descriptions. So here you've got the discipler, and we've all been that. But the discipler is trying to engage or put into that person's life the basics of what it takes to follow Christ. Discipling, in our mind, Bobby and I, is part of mentoring being the bigger picture. But then you have the spiritual guide. This person you need all your life. I have a spiritual guide. They're not just go out there and get one, just like you can get a discipler. Spiritual guides been around for a while. They walk with God, and you are drawn to them because of Christ in them. You mean in terms of memories, writings? Absolutely, yeah. And I would say that a big one for me is George Mueller. I've got all his books, and I read them a number of times every year. And one that I've got, I've just written in so many times. And so I'll get into situations and say, Let's see, it's about one-third way through the book. That's it. Oh, there it is. He dealt with that. Very similar. And so he mentors me spiritually. Uh-huh. Very good. And then we talk about the coach. The coach is one of the things that a lot of people need today. That's one of the biggest forms of mentoring that goes on, helping someone do something. Remember, in mentoring, someone knows something you want to know. Someone has already done something you want to do. So the key is just find it. And you could be that person. And so these are more intensive relationships. The next one, teacher, counselor, are more occasional. You get involved. A lot of you have been that. And then this one here, the passive, this, the big one here is, of course, models. And as I said before, desperate need for models. But we need these in our life. And I've put this this way. The community a person needs to grow. And for you folks, there are a number of special areas. I divide it like this. A young person coming up, 20s and 30s, they need models that inspire and show them the way. They need mentors who will develop and empower them. They need partners who will strengthen them. And that's just that's a kind of a kindred spirit, a partner. You know, like you go to NAV conferences and you haven't seen staff for a long time and all of a sudden, but you're attracted to one person. Because you think alike. You may not be best friends, but you're in the saddle together. You kind of, there's something, when we talk together, we stir one another. And that's what we're talking about with partners. Boy, partners are absolutely crucial for us. And we need them. And then finally, friends who support us. One thing I've learned is that people who will make it the long range have a couple of close friends and partners around them. You get to a certain age at this point, like I say, and you get into the 50s and 60s, it's not so much models and mentors you need as much as you need partners and friends. Because your mentors will often be your partners and your friends as you get older. Now, I still have one. For instance, Phyllis and I, we now have five grandchildren and a sixth one coming. And we really want to do it right. We want to know how to get involved with them. And we also want to know how to get our adult children, bring them together and, you know, periodically and whether we call a family reunion or whatever. So I thought, well, now who's done that? Well, Lauren Sani has. So I went and talked to Lauren, my wife and I did, and we said, Lauren, what have you learned from having family reunions? He says, well, I can tell you a lot of what you shouldn't do. And so, I mean, he gave us a list of things, you know, and we had told him before in advance we're going to talk about this. So typically, Lauren, he just had these things set. Told us a lot of good things. So we've saved. See, somebody knows something we need to know. Somebody has already done something we're about to do. And so regardless of how old you are, he's done that. And I've asked other people as well, how do you involve yourself with your grandchildren? And so anyhow, we've done that. So we always need some mentors. But these are the areas perhaps you become that. You are models and you are mentors to many of the next generation. But you need partners and friends. There was a fellow that was coming off the mission field, and he's a writer of books. He's been involved in leading an organization. And I met him in Hong Kong, and we were chatting, and he said, you know, I'm wondering where I've got to move back. Hong Kong is closing up and for us, and they had spent 16 years in Europe, and he's a tremendous teacher and, you know, sought a lot of places would like to have him. And so he says, you know, I'm thinking of transportation, where to live. I'm thinking of this, I'm thinking of that, and my parents and other things. He says, what do you think? And so we got to talk, and I said, you know, if it were me, I would go somewhere where some people are that you want to be with and will help you finish well. And so he said, let's talk. Let's talk more about that. We did, and a year ago, he moved into Colorado Springs. We have really enjoyed that relationship, and we'll keep enjoying it, and there are others as well. Because they're going to help us finish well, and we're going to help them. You need each other. You need those close friendships. By and large, just as a commentary, navigators tend to emphasize vertical relationships and put very little time in the horizontal relationship. As you get older, those horizontal relationships are going to be the ones that will bring you through. Will be the strong part. Will be the prayer partners. Will be the ones you walk with through and finish strong and well. Don't neglect them. Young 30-year-olds neglect them all the time because they want to be investing in that person and getting this. And we can't stop that. But we've got to make sure we're spending time and money to get with other people. We often slight that because we don't think I shouldn't give the time to that when I could be meeting with someone here. Or take a weekend off someplace or a whole week with somebody and just be together. Phyllis and I are trying to do that. My tendency is to make everything count in that same way, but this counts too. And so these last years we've been spending time getting away for a weekend with some of these special couples. And boy, it just makes a difference. They know you, they pray with you, they're there, they're praying for our kids. Right now one of them is the result of an idea we talked about. He's away with his adult children trying to reestablish a new paradigm around their relationship as a family. Bringing a sense of pursuing the Great Commission as a family and helping each other. Never talked about, never knew, but he just discovered that, how he could affect the family, and he's just moving that in, and it's exciting what's happening. Well, we're with him on that. I keep thinking all day and all yesterday, praying for him. So this is the kind of people we need. We struggle, we just got to invest laterally. Don't miss it. Well, that's about, you guys know so much about it. I've been trying to pick out the things you don't know, huh? And there are very few things. So I think that's about it right now. What I'd like to do is just open it up and just see if you have any questions or we can interact or anything about anything I've said or whatever. Yes, right.
You and I had talked about it back in January. You had some great points about why it's so hard to transition from the typical navigator into, I guess, from the Paul Timothy to the Barnabas. Can you share some of those thoughts that you had?
Well, I think it's hard because we've developed such a mentality of a strong investment into a person. We set the agenda. We go there prepared. We do that for someone. And that's good. And the Lord has used that. But to shift that over to a more relaxed relationship where the emphasis is on the relationship and letting that person develop the let that person establish the agenda, really is a paradigm shift for us. We feel inadequate when we're not doing something that's significantly, leaving them with assignment, doing something here, or going after that. And so I have just found that it's very difficult shifting over to just be friends with that person, even an older friend, kind of walk along with them, and not maybe see some things happening dynamically right away. Now, I know some of you are really into that, have really worked at that. I know you, Paul, have been working on some of that with the military, haven't you? How's that going, without just a short shot on that, is in terms of not the military, but relating to some of these younger staff and not necessarily, you're not training them or developing them, you're just being a Barnabas to them.
You shared some of that on whatever it is, Saturday.
Okay. Well, and that's absolutely crucial to see that happen. We've been doing some work on this whole idea of transitions, and one of the things that affects you here is that when we move into new situations like this, shifting a paradigm over, you have this in here, and I know there's always some there that if you put something up and don't do anything with it, you feel like you've missed something that somebody was saying. And what did he mean by this crazy demonstration or this part here? But what we're really talking about in this area is just, this is kind of the before, the old. This is what is called transition. And I got some ideas from this fellow named William Bridges, who wrote the book Transitions and Managing Transitions. And then this is the after, or the new. And it really helped me, because a lot of us, when we get into a situation, something needs to die. There needs to come a death and then a birth.
into a new relationship. And you can follow this with little things or big things. It really helped me. But like, for instance, we used to do it this way, and this was part of my life. I used to be a navigator in responsibility, or I used to do this. That's all that's past. That needs to come to a death. Then I transition. I pray through. I journal. I walk through. I listen. I readjust. And I think through. Now, what from this will come over? What will bridge over? What will be true here and also true there? But what will not be? What will be remain here and never go further? New relationships. New opportunities. I do this with our children. When our children, I explain that as they were leaving into college. You know, before we've had this kind of relationship. We characterized it. And now we're going to be in some transition. What would be realistic? What would be the kind of relationship we'd want? When they were married, we asked them, after they've been married several months, what kind of relationship would you like with mom and dad? Let's talk about that. We've been very involved in your life. We've been talking about things. Now you're married, and it's different. Well, how would you like to relate to us? Think about that, and we're coming down this weekend, and we're going to see each other. Let's talk about that. And what we did is we did talk about what was true here and what needed to be there. But we had a transition, and they did too. We had to reestablish this and think it through. But just like you were talking about, Roy, and what did I do nor formally do with staff? And what can I do with staff now? And it's a different relationship. Sometimes that transition period takes just a little time, and transition really speaks to the inner change. Change speaks to the external change. But it really is an important time to rethink. And my observation is this, that it's the success of continual transitions, good transitions, whether you go from a job to a place, it's the success, the accumulation of successes of these transitions that gives wisdom. That's where wisdom comes from. But what happens with us? We are so busy in our life, we move through, and we don't take the time to think about the transition. And so because we don't think about it, we just move on. And suddenly you get to about three or four transitions later, and you're reacting or you're feeling something, but it really isn't because of what's happening now, but it's what's happening a while ago. And it's important to transition, go back through these things. So I picked this out from Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transition, man is great. Transitions are important. Okay? Any other questions? Thoughts? Yes?
Well, relating to a couple comments you just made in relationship to transition into your life and then the busyness of life, on the back page, you have one of the characteristics of those who plan well.
Uh-huh.
They enjoy intimacy with Christ, they have experienced repeated times of inner renewal.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Inner life development is an ongoing thing, but it's more than just an accumulation of quiet times or getting away a little bit. I find that it's probably the area that I'm asked about the most with staff. How do I go deeper? Nobody's in sin. No one has not stopped loving God. They're loving God, but how do we get deeper? The first thing that I think is very important for someone to do and for me to do is to identify those things which nurture the intimacy with God. What is it? You do Bible study, scripture memory, quiet time. You get off and listen to music. You take walks. You get extended times alone with God. Go on and on. You can just, you read devotional thoughts from, what is it that when you do it draws you closer to God? And if you can get it down to the most important one, then make sure that that's in your schedule on a regular basis weekly. Don't try to do a lot of things. At this point in your life, you know which ones. For instance, with me, the thing that draws me closest, the most intimate with Christ, is when I take a psalm and pray, read it and pray, and just pray through a psalm. Now, I've identified 21 psalms that I can go to any one of those 21 psalms and they immediately just draw me into Christ, draw me into God. And so that's mine. That's my thing. And so I do that
at least 3 or 4 times a week. Just spend the time to do that, because it's intimacy you'll take on. Well, secondly, I think, is these times where you need to get away alone with God. And you need some different ways, not just going on by yourself, but try different things. Now, for me, just could say what I've done is looked into this whole idea of spiritual reflective reading that you bring back to God. And reading from the Scriptures and then back into God. Reading from the Scriptures back into God. Well, the one order, or the one group of people that do this the most is the Benedictine order. St. Benedict had this as one of his rules, and they had to do this. So I didn't know where to go other than the Benedictine. So I called them up and asked if I could retreat there for 5 days and learn that. And I did. And I went there and spent... Now, people question my motives when they hear this, but it's just right outside of Aspen, the monastery. I didn't go there at all. But I spent 5 days under their direction, interaction with them. There's some men there that really walk with God. And they taught me how to read the Scriptures and bring them back to God. Now, I thought I had done that before. I thought I had done a lot of it, but it just brought a whole new dimension into my reading and interacting with God through the Scriptures. And so I feel when you get to a certain age, you've been walking with God many years, you need to spice your life on a regular basis with pulling away, getting new input, new times. You know, I was talking to this one staff, and anybody been on the Emmaus Walk? Yeah, okay. Well, you know, a lot of people go to that, and you say, well, it's a Methodist thing. Navigators know more than that. So, but I suggested to this one staff, go on the Emmaus Walk. I've never been on one, but I've had three of my close friends go, and I'd like to go on one, but maybe you should just go on one, because they just were sensing some need to, and they went, and they came back, and I said, thanks. It was a blessing. Because we bring all of ourselves and all that we've known into that experience, and some people are there for the first time in their life doing anything like that, and we may be for many times we've done things, but we bring in a whole new dimension when we have that. But the someone once said, there are two intimacies you need to guard to really finish life well, and that's intimacy with God and intimacy with your spouse or a couple of very close people if your spouse is gone. Intimacy, boy, it's just it's a lifelong pursuit, and it's the first thing that can go and hurt us. So that's what we meant by continual, you know, trying times of renewal. How are we doing? Another question? Or?
Let's take a 5 minute break. And
One more question, and that's we'll call it. At all. Okay, well, we don't want to force it. Listen, it's just been wonderful. Yes? Yeah, she's wired together differently than myself. She can do it more on a regular basis alone. She retreats to a Marriott, and she can get alone. Goes in there around 8:30, 9 when the breakfast traffic is out, and spends several hours, or she'll go off for a whole day. And she's able to do it. I'm the type of person that if I don't cut it out and get alone and get away, God will not get my intention. And so she does it in a different way that fitting more to her. I think that's, as I talk to a lot of men seem to have more difficulty with it, of getting, so we need to get away. And I think that for me, the busiest thing, the hardest thing to do is to not stop the physical busyness and physical noise in my life. It's to stop the inner noise and the inner busyness. And so for me to get away, I've worked through that, and I'll have to, if I get away for time like that, it just takes me time to even do that. I found that a lot of the scripture and songs are these, you know, praise courses really help me unplug and then plug that little transition period. That's helped me a lot. Do you think that's important?
Yes.
Oh, man.
But a lot of men don't, you don't
Oh, okay. Well, just like she said. Oh, well, that is absolutely crucial, and I think a lot of you probably have done that just to ensure that. But I'll tell you one thing. Not only do we need to make that clear, because and like many of you, we've practiced that to get Phyllis away different times. But I think when you mentor, make sure that that's true, because 30-year-olds won't think of that, most of them. They're so busy, and even the wife won't think of that. And it's absolutely crucial in your mentoring. Now, a little challenge that Rod mentioned to me, he says, you know, we've got this Edge Corps over there, a bunch of young kids that are going to be the future of the Navigators. They need mentors. And we've got a bunch of contact staff, we used to call them, or their interim staff, we call them now, that are starting out. I wonder if some of you would take it as a challenge from some of us to look up, either get a roster from those Edge Corps and pick one out and get a hold of them and write them. And we did, by the way. I just wanted to let you know, he shared that. We took on one guy and one girl from 2 years ago. And we've written, called, gotten involved in all kinds of things with them. And one of them just stayed at our house because they came here for the Edge Corps deal and stayed the night with us. And we went way into the night. We knew that, though, we'd go into it. So we slept longer the last night before. But they are just such a treat. And it keeps you developing, keeps you going, their questions, their vibrance. But, you know, if our younger gang's going to make it in this life, they're going to need some folk like you. Not only older people in their life, but they need people with your experience, your life, what you've given your life to. So with that, let me end and let me pray. Lord God, you know what a strategic need this is. And I just want to stop for a moment and thank you for the lives that have invested in our lives. The many that are here could tell stories we could have gone on all afternoon into the evening of the men and women that have invested in our lives. Teachers, coaches, disciplers, NAV staff, pastors, friends along the way. Lord, you've used them all to make us a lot of what we are today. And we just thank you for that. And Lord, I would pray that the brothers and sisters are here this afternoon. For us, Lord, help us to leave a legacy in the lives of, first of all, our children and our children's children, and then into the lives of NAV staff, of young pastors, of couples, moms and dads, teachers, wherever they are, Lord. Help us to be agents of God, investing in such a way that you pour your love, all the experience you've given to us, the lessons you've taught us, that we can pour them into others, that they might become godly, well-equipped, and able to finish the course well and make investments into the next generation that will ripple across not only this country, but across the world. Help us, Lord, that the investments and efforts of a lifetime, as Moses prayed, will really count. And I thank you for each one of these. In Jesus' name, amen.